Okay, good morning, everyone. Well, I can't see all your faces. It's great to know you're here. And we're engaged in a practice called presenting the path. So please make yourselves comfortable in your seat. Make your back straight and your shoulders relaxed. Tuck your chin in ever so slightly. And allow the body to breathe itself. And while that's going on, become aware of the movements that take place either at the belly or the upper chest. And then imagine if the spiritual families of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas were to arrive from the 10 directions of space and appear just in front of you. And that meanwhile, every sentient being was sitting and surrounding you. And that every one of them were related to you, either as a parent, an uncle or aunt, a brother, a sister, or a child. And that in these relationships, your happiness always depended upon their kindness. And while they too wish to be happy and equally to avoid suffering, every one of them has never been genuinely happy. But now that all the auspicious causes and conditions to awaken are present, form the resolve to quickly attain for them the state of enlightenment. And by doing so, turn their mind to the truth, to be able to practice that truth as a path, to remove obstacles from the path, and to purify their confusion into wisdom, thereby revealing their natural birthright, a state of unchanging goodness. And to accomplish this, we're going to take refuge in the families of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas who are in front of us, and we're going to generate the mind of enlightenment. So, taking refuge. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. Now, to establish this wish stably and to increase it, we'll recite the prayer called the Four Immeasurables. May all sentient beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. May all sentient beings be inseparable from the happiness that is free from suffering. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. Now, enlightenment for the benefit of others requires that we accumulate vast stores of merit and purify the mind. And these practices are all summed up in a prayer called the Seven Limbs. So we'll recite this together. Reverently, I prostrate with my body, speech, and mind. I present clouds of every type of offering, actual and imagined. I declare all my negative actions accumulated since beginning this time and rejoice in the meritable, holy, and ordinary beings. Please remain until the end of psychic existence and turn the wheel of Dharma for living beings. I dedicate my own merits and those of all others to the great enlightenment. So another thing that really prevents us from becoming enlightened for the benefit of others are different forms of attachment and clinging. And the essence of the next practice is to let go of the clinging to our body, our mind, our identity, in fact, and all the things that we hold precious to us, in particular, our merit. And in the absence of the clinging, imagine that your body takes on the form of a wonderful and pure land where all beings can sit and take teachings from you when you're enlightened. And you're going to offer this up, this absence of clinging in the form, to the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas in front of us. Now this ground, anointed with perfume, strewn with flowers, adorned with Mount Meru, four continents, the sun and the moon. I imagine this is a Buddha field and offer it. May all living beings enjoy this pure land. Idam Guratna Mandala Kamneryatayami. So we release the offering and it's accepted by the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas in front of us. They smile at us in delight. And this vast refuge field begins to dissolve into light, melting into the central figure of Shakyamuni Buddha. It becomes quite small and moves through space to abide above the crown of your head. And facing the same way you are, it begins to descend, entering your skull, and down and resting at the level of your heart. With radiance begins to increase, filling your body and mind. Light goes out through the pores of your skin, into the 10 directions of space, and wherever there are sentient beings within space, they are touched by that light and transformed immediately. And now appear as fully awakened beings, with light rays expanding from their heart center into the 10 directions of space. And you rest your awareness in this vast field of spacious light. On your next in-breath, imagine the light withdrawing from the 10 directions of space, once again re-entering your body at the level of the heart. And have the light become quite small, but knowledgeable. And acknowledge that you have this potential to become fully awakened, and this is the natural potential of the mind. And you're going to awaken this potential through everything that you do with your body, speech, and mind to bring about the welfare of yourself and every other living being. And that by engaging in this meditation and these classes, these are conditions that get you ever closer to that goal. Now breathing in through your nostrils. Exhale through your mouth. And allow your awareness to bring you back into the room and to find you sitting in front of your screen. And now I'll move over to the course itself, and we'll begin that shortly. So you can see here that we're up to class 6, and we've covered quite a bit of material. So in brief, we've looked at the paths practiced in the three levels of an individual, and these paths being, so these practices being the initial level, medium level, and advanced levels of practice. And these have been covered by the 7 verses that we've been looking at in the Lam Rim Prayer. So I'm just going to go like a brief sort of summary using these verses and the paths practiced. So in the first verse, there was a homage or prostration made, and the author introduces to the three principal aspects of the path. And the first preliminary training, or first training of the initial level. So these three principles of the path were renunciation, bodhicitta, and the correct view. And the first practice of the initial level was guru devotion, or the how to rely upon a teacher. Then in the second verse, there was an encouragement to listen to the teachings and engage in study of them. And so this introduced us to the second of the trainings for the initial level, how to meditate, but also how to take advantage of the life you have with its leisure and opportunity. Now verses 3, 4, and 5 dealt with the medium level, whereby we're encouraged to develop a pure renunciation. So verse 3 introduced us to the topic of renunciation and explained its importance. Verse 4 introduced us to the actual practices, and verse 5 was the measurement of success. And then we find in the advanced levels, it's repeated, right? We are introduced to the importance of bodhicitta, verse 6, verse 6 introduced us to the importance of it, and then verse 7, the methods for practicing it. If you remember, the methods were being 6 causes of one effect, the equalizing, exchanging self for others, and the merging of these two in Lama Tsongkhapa's special presentation of the 11 points. So if you can, I'd like you to sort of, in your own mind, try and do this yourself. You know, summarize very quickly what the, you know, the 7 verses that we've gone through, and then how they relate to the 3 principal aspects and the 3 levels of the individual. So today, I'll come to shortly. First of all, look, I've used all these books here. I've been relying on these to present the material to you. They're all very, very good. Of course, I could add others too. There's another book that I've relied on today called Teachings from Tibet. And you know, it's called Teachings from Tibet, Guidance from Great Lamas. And it comes out through the organization called the FPMT. We have this book free here, but you can also pick it up, I think, for about $1 online. And it's wonderful because it covers, you know, renunciation, bodhicitta, correct view. It's got the 8 verses of thought transformation in it. It's got the 3 levels of practitioner. And it's got a tremendous section on emptiness, which we'll be talking about today. Now, today we're really going to keep talking about the advanced level of practitioner. So remember here, the person is practicing bodhicitta. We talked about this last week, of course, and today we're just going to finish off the last verse of this, it's verse 8, and then we're going to have a look at the view. So we've got bodhicitta, so we've got renunciation, bodhicitta, and the correct view. So the correct view, when it's merged with bodhicitta, the mind of enlightenment, and the practices that go with it, you can become a fully enlightened, fully awakened person called a Buddha. When the correct view is brought together with the teachings of renunciation, you bring about your own personal liberation from cyclic existence. And so this view is called the supramundane view, or the view of emptiness, the correct view. Now there's a mundane view also, and that mundane view is the practice of karma and karmic cause and effect. And when that is mixed with the practices of the initial scope, you bring about your rebirth in the higher realms. So the next few slides, I showed them to you last week, so we're just going to go briefly through through those slides. And I'm doing that because this verse 8 is like a continuation of verse 7 that we looked at last week. So let's go there. So remember last week we had this young man being swept down the river. And this is taking place in the darkness. So this was in verse 7. So it says, carried away by the torrents of four fierce rivers, bound by tight fetters of karma, difficult to undo, caught up in the iron net of self-grasping, completely enveloped in the pitch black ignorance, in the pitch black darkness of ignorance. So let's just bring up some of these things. So it is irreversible contaminated actions. This is the karma that's swept them down. And joined with these afflictions. And here they're at the causal level, desire, ripening karma views, and ignorance. And they bring about the effect of rebirth, old age, sickness, and death.
Eddie, can you just remind me why they called irreversible contaminated actions?
Because it produces, there's no, it's like, so, yeah, if we look at, it's the, we're talking about the last action that produces the rebirth. So once it's taken, it's irreversible.
Oh, okay. So once we have the rebirth, we can't undo our rebirth.
Can't undo that.
No. Okay, getcha. Yeah.
And it took an action to do that. You know, a contaminated action. Yeah. So that's what's saying. You know, once it's like, once we find here, we can't go, oh damn, I really should be enlightened, or just being an animal. It's done. Yeah. It's like that. So now here, folks. Okay, what's this net representing? Anyone? Can somebody type in something?
Get your typing fingers ready, everybody. What does the net represent? I'm just waiting for the... Sue Wall says karma. The net of karma.
So...
And Alison La says samsara.
Okay. So here it's useful to remember the verse, you know, it said, or somebody
and,
else.
Anthea says clinging attachment.
Yep. So remember it said caught up in the iron net of self-grasping.
So is this self-grasping just tangles us up?
Yep. And here was like this... enveloped in the pitchfork. So here we've got this, you know, bound by the tight fetters of karma here. And what's this one here, folks?
It So the net is what, Eddie?
The iron net of self-grasping.
Self-grasping. And then
the cage is what, the tight fetters of karma. And this one here is the pitch black
darkness. Ignorance.
Ignorance. The verse goes on to say, born into boundless cyclic existence. So here we have them. And in rebirths, unceasingly tormented by the three sufferings. Contemplating the state of mother sentient beings in such conditions generate the supreme mind. So what's the supreme mind, anyone?
The supreme mind. Anne says enlightenment.
Very close. That's half the answer.
And Sue Wall says the mind of enlightenment.
That's right. The mind of enlightenment.
So what I find amazing about this verse, Eddie, is that when we go through it, you know, I still can't help thinking about, oh, this is my problems. But actually, this is about thinking about, this is the problems of all samsaric beings. Everybody's suffering.
Yeah, so that leads me up to what I'm about to say next, Biffy, because when we consider it as my sufferings, which they are, this is how we generate renunciation and a determination to be free. But when we think that this is happening to everybody, and, you know, then from that great compassion, but then there's this thing of going, I'm going to put an end to it. I'm going to help everyone free themselves of this great river of suffering. You know, then we have bodhicitta. So when it's self-focused, renunciation, when it's focused on others, we have the mind of enlightenment. So this verse can be used in those two ways. You know, like I said, once it's, if you look at oneself, but as well as I should say, one has to have the view also. It's not enough just to wish to be free, because if you can't be free, the wish is pointless.
Yep,
it's because we know you can be free.
Everybody wishes to be free anyway.
Yeah, but it's like you also got to have the knowledge that you can be free. It's like, you know, it's pointless. If you've got a life sentence in jail, you can want to be free as much as you like, but you're not going to be. But if you find yourself like in jail with, you know, like in, you know, for 10 years or so, you know, okay, after 10 years, I'm free. So there's a difference here, right? Without the view, without knowing that you can be free, the wish itself, not much power there, is there? Not much strength. It's just the wish. Many of us have wishes that will never come true. You know, can't, perhaps even can't come true. Here, this wish is combined with the knowledge that one can be free.
Jeanette said, I thought that the net was like a safety net, but then I didn't consider the verse. And actually, it's really good that you said that, Jeanette, because often our self-grasping, is something that we think is our safety net, you know, where people go, look out for number one, and yet it tangles us up.
That's very true. Yeah, that's right, Jeanette. And this is what it's sort of also getting at. You know, like, and here we could also look at this net being self-grasping ignorance, but we could also see it as being the self-cherishing mind. Right? Where, you know, we have self-cherishing and self-grasping together, and our focus is on me. And we think that's, you know, the way to go in life. That will bring about a sense of safety and have our wishes granted. So, you know, that's a great insight you've brought to the class, Jeanette. Now, we often think that, you know, that this is the way to be happy. And, of course, it's encouraged in our society. So in relationship to this, I'll just read you what His Holiness had said. So these verses explain two ways of generating renunciation and the determination to be free through thinking about true sufferings. These are to reflect or to think about the faults and sufferings of cyclic existence and to reflect on the true origins of that suffering. You know, so we've got down the bottom of the act, the cyclic existence, and then we've got desire, ripening karma views, and ignorance as being the causes of it. So when the verse explains the levels of sufferings and so forth, it's explaining a true suffering. And when it explains factors like the conception of true existence, ignorance, and the contaminated actions, it's explaining the true origins of suffering. So in this way, it explains the first two noble truths. Now, if you think about the cycle of suffering and its origins with reference to other sentient beings, it will lead to training in compassion. But if you think about these sufferings and their origins with reference to yourself, it leads to the generation of a determination to be free. Which leads us on to this verse 8, you know, which I've said before, in a never-ending cycle and birth after birth, they're tormented without a break by the three types of suffering. Think about how your mothers feel. Think about what's happening to them. Develop the supreme mind of enlightenment. So to do this, we have to first observe the sufferings of sentient beings and then generate a strong feeling of closeness and affection for them. So the closer we feel to others, the easier it will be to generate the feeling of being unbearable to bear their sufferings. Therefore, we should view all sentient beings as our relatives, such as our mother. Now today, this morning I read a little thing about the Lama's Opus teachings on thought transformation. And in his motivation, he said, in relationship to this, what I thought it was, he said, it's as if, suppose you're standing in front of a fire and a spark lifted up and landed on you. You would immediately go, when it starts to burn you, right? You immediately go to sweep that spark off you. And he was saying, so think of, in the same way you wish to remove that spark, he says, think that, you know, these sparks have landed on all beings and they are your children. And then you see them suffering. And just as you can't bear your own suffering when the spark landed on you, you cannot bear the thought that your own child will experience this type of suffering. So you immediately go to sweep the suffering off them. So this is why it's important with us. We've first got to acknowledge our own and wish to be free of it. You know, and to see it really sort of deeply, not just the suffering of pain or the suffering of change, but the suffering of all pervasive conditioning. And acknowledge that this is not just going on with us, it's going on with every other living being. So I read an interesting thing the other day where it said in the Pali tradition, they often look at all sentient beings as being our children. And in the Sanskrit traditions, we're looking at all beings as being our mothers. But it really doesn't, the whole point of it is to develop other compassion and loving kindness. His Holiness says, in order to generate the mental attitude of concern for other sentient beings, we must first understand the beginningless nature of cyclic existence. The sentient beings who have taken birth in cyclic existence are also without beginning. Therefore, there is no sentient being you can say who has not been connected to you as a relative, such as your mother. So the words mother and sentient beings here clearly show that suffering sentient beings are not totally unrelated to us. They've acted as our mother in previous lives or have been our children in previous lives. And while they were kind to us. So we have to sort of see them as pleasing. And if we can do that, we'll feel close to them. And if you sort of understand through contemplating these different levels of suffering, how much your mothers suffer or your children suffer or your relatives suffer, this will really inspire you to act quickly to stop that suffering. Do you remember here, like this mind of enlightenment is, its foundation is a great compassion. And so it's not just compassion where we might wish that others would be free of suffering. It's great because it has all sentient beings as its object of focus. But it's also great because it means you're not just going to wish them to, you're going to do something about it. You're going to be responsible for their freedom from suffering. So this is what really makes it great. And as a means to train in that, we can practice the method of taking and giving called Tonglen. So once again, you've seen these slides again, but I'm just refreshing your mind and we're not going to spend much time on it. So remember when we said about when you start with the practice of Tonglen, it's best to start with oneself first and look at the future sufferings that you'll experience as long as you remain within cyclic existence. Then to take that understanding away and place it on others. And remember, we do this on the breath. We take the suffering inwards on the breath, often visualized as smoke. And so when we're taking this suffering on, what we're doing within ourselves is inspiring an attitude of courageous compassion. Then we move on to the practice of giving. And once again, it's suggested we begin with ourselves and look at what we'll need in the future. So we'll need ordinary happiness, but we'll also need the extraordinary happiness, the happiness of the true cessations and liberation and enlightenment. We'll see that others will need the same. And so we imagine ourselves giving away these different forms of happiness. We imagine giving away everything lovely, and that's to inspire within ourselves a sense of selfless love. Now, the question is how do I know I've actually got the mind of enlightenment? How can I measure the success of my practice? So this is not a verse you'll find in any other text. I've put it up like this because there's nothing I can find that actually says it's like this. But you'll see when you look at this verse, this is very much like the verse of renunciation, and I've done that on purpose. But here it is. It says that with practice of the mind of enlightenment, with practices of the six causes and one effect, exchanging self and other, Tonglen, with these practices, your mind won't entertain even passing fantasies of mundane wealth, fame, or freedom. Now, freedom here means personal freedom, your own individual freedom. Instead, we'll aim for enlightenment day and night. It's then you've developed the Bodhi mind. So
Eddie, this is a little bit like when we hear that bodhisattvas have determined then they're going to put off their own enlightenment to continue to work for sentient beings. So this is alluding to that, isn't it? Of the
But the enlightenment they're putting off is the enlightenment of solitary peace.
Yep. So that freedom, that's putting off their own. Right. Yep.
Yeah. It's that's right. It's putting off the idea that I'm just going to, like, this is too difficult. I'm really just going to become enlightened myself. That's what the freedom is meaning.
Right. Yeah.
Without, you know, if you take that attitude, that is, the vehicle, if you take that attitude and engage in practices to do that, those are the vehicles of the of the medium scope, personal freedom, renunciation with the view, which produces individual, the individual solitary peace of liberation.
Yeah, so that that kind of common saying of the bodhisattvas not becoming enlightened until all sentient beings are liberated, actually this gives it its details, doesn't it?
Yeah, and so
it clarifies it.
Yeah, we can't take that to be literally true either. That's an attitude.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay. So that's like. So how do we do that specifically? So when we have true success is achieved when the mind undergoes a non-contrived or non-factitious change. This is a point at which one has achieved such thorough familiarity with the intended subject that one no longer has to rely directly on effort to reinduce it at any time. So what does that mean, in simple language? I think in simple language, the best way I can explain to you is through an analogy or something like that. So now me, I do not know how to drive a car. But I do know that cars can be driven and many people drive them. So if I was to learn to drive a car, it would take some effort to do so, wouldn't it? Just like it took effort for you guys who drive. Right? So I would probably have to start reading, become familiar with the laws of the road. Not only would I have to do that, I'd actually have to hop in a car and get instruction on it. And like turn the key and move your feet. And I have driven a car before, but I don't like it much. There's so much you have to do, and you have to sort of learn it in order. You turn the key, you push your feet, look behind you. And somebody sits there and tells you to do that, and you've got to sort of remember what to do. And then you do it, and you're not very good at it. But over time, you get better and better at it. And then comes the stage where you don't even have to think of it. You just open the door, hop in, you just turn the key, you turn around and out you go. So when you're like that, when you don't have to think about it, you just do it because it's so ingrained in you. You know what to do without relying on anyone else's assistance or bringing it all to mind. Right? That's what they call uncontrived, non-factitious. You're so thoroughly familiar with what to do, you don't have to rely or you don't have to reinduce it. You don't have to sit in there and go, right now, turn the key, look up.
You don't have to be like me that I have this little scrap of paper in my wallet saying the order to put the key in the ignition, turn it, put the clutch here, put the foot there,
And then go. Yeah. So, like for us, we actually, to bring about the mind of enlightenment in your training, you have to learn about the six causes one effect, become really familiar with it. And there's a lot in that practice. Then you learn about the equalizing, exchanging self for other method. Then you've got to put them back, then you've got to put them together when you actually meditate on trying to develop the mind of enlightenment. You've got to go through each step, And then you've got to sort of have this great compassion and urgency to become fully enlightened. But when you have it, you don't need to go through all that because you've got it. So when you're like that, that's the moment of truth. That's how you know you've truly got it. You're sort of going out into the world with this sort of like fierce determination to put an end to everybody's suffering by becoming enlightened. That's your modus operandi. You just get up in the morning, you don't just sort of, you know, sit down and, now what's the first one? You have familiarized with it so thoroughly that your mind now, this is your main mind.
So it's completely ingrained in your mind. You couldn't, you know, you couldn't actually forget it or get rid of it.
No. So then once you have this, now you're called a bodhisattva. You've entered the path of accumulation and so forth. So you enter the path of accumulation. You've accumulated all the causes and conditions for it, and you have it. And you don't need to accumulate causes and so forth anymore to have it. I should let you know, though, it can still be lost for a period of time. If you don't familiarizing yourself with it, right, you can lose it. So this is very much like, you know how to drive a car. It's ingrained within you somewhere. But suppose you don't drive for 30 or 40 years. Right? You could go in there and then you started going, you know, like things have changed and you have to sort of go much slower.
I'm just thinking about that analogy that you're using, Eddie, because, you know, I did get my license and it did start the driving, you know, I didn't have to look at my piece of paper with my little checklist in order. Mm-hmm. But because then I didn't drive very much. Now I've forgotten it all. You know, now I don't drive at all. So I really get that. It would take me a lot to get back on again.
Yeah, this is right.
Yep. Jeanette says learning to drive a car, she feels, is like attainable in a short period of time, but developing the mind of enlightenment takes lifetimes and sometimes feels unattainable.
Yep. Yeah, so not all feelings are true, Jeanette.
and also what really encourages me is how Venerable Gyatso said, you know, with those lifetimes and lifetimes and eons, ooh, we're not at the beginning of those eons. We're at the end of those eons. We're nearly there.
That's right. You know, you think of it, you've got a life with a leisured opportunity to engage in practice. We've met authentic teachers. We've found the teachings. This is so rare for this to happen. We're actually interested in it. There's so many people that don't even have that. So they're even further away than us, Jeanette. And once again, like you're saying, though, you can you could think it's impossible, take ages. And it could do, but it might not also. And if you have the idea that it could not be done, you have got to ask yourself, why not? What's my reason? When others have done it, obviously it can be done. The real question is, why am I unable to do it?
Mm.
And then you'll find that most of your energy is put into this life. It's maintaining your status, your family, keeping your home, going shopping, going on holiday. That's why. Your mind is not engaged in it. So it's quite simple, really. I mean, the explanation of it, but, you know, the undoing of it is not simple. It's hard. That requires a lot of effort.
So Jeanette's saying, yep, that's true, too involved in samsara.
Yeah.
Nicola has a question. When does the familiarization turn into a realization? Are they kind of different things?
Yes, that's right. That's right, Nicola. So realization comes about through great familiarization. So, you know, we can have, you will have through the process of familiarizing yourself with the trainings in the Mind of Enlightenment, you will have certain experiences, or certain experiences will take place. But those experiences aren't realizations until, like, you get to the end, sort of thing.
So familiarization is the first step, and then we have realizations, and then we have stability is achieved. That's, and we have a consummation of it.
That's right. Yeah. So even when we realize something, we've got a stable mind in what it's realized. And to bring that about, we really need a mind that's quite powerful and strong and stable, which is the mind of calm abiding. So all of this material is, analytical. We've got to analyze. And each step of the seven causes to produce that effect need to be, like, realized. We've got to realize that the mind is beginningless and endless. Samsara has no beginning. All beings have been my parents, children, uncles, aunts. And actually sort of get that sort of shock that, Jesus, that's true. And then see that they're no different than ourselves. Go through those stages bit by bit and get that sort of realization, understanding. But you've also got to understand that your own freedom is possible just through the nature of the mind and the different trainings you can place the mind under. So for that, I really do suggest you have a read of those books put up by the Dalai Lama and Venerable Thupten Chodron, those five books that I showed you today, because there's terrific writing you can all understand in that, that, you can test it. It is reasonable, it's sensible, it's just like, this is the way it is. So for us, I think for most of us, we could say, oh my gosh, yes, but then we don't do anything with that knowledge. We don't actually sit down, and to try to become knowledgeable about our own mind, because it's the undisciplined mind that produces the suffering. It's the disciplined mind that brings about the cessation of suffering. So, we've actually got to believe that, have faith in it, sit down, and then start developing our knowledge of the mind itself.
So Anthea says this driving metaphor is fantastic, because we can drive with focus and care for others, or we can drive timidly or distracted and with overconfidence. Or and drunk. Obviously the best mode is driving awake and alert and, being considerate and patient.
Yeah, this is right. Yeah.
Alison Lalam asks, so what happens when every sentient being becomes enlightened?
What do you think, Alison?
We have a big party.
Job's done. The result is attained. Yep. So I've come to here, and this is with this verse, verse 8, we've really been talking about here. And now I'm going to, once we've, we've developed this mind of enlightenment, so we wish to become enlightened, it's authentic, we want to do it for the sake of others. This wish is an authentic wish. It's deeply ingrained, like I said, non-factitious, uncontrived. So, we have to act on our wish. It's like, hey, great, I want to do it. What do I do? The answer is engage in the practices of the six perfections. So we're going to have a look at those now. And then we're going to come up with verse 9, where we talk about the importance of the view. So just a few slides about the division, the perfections, and in particular, the perfection of patience. So I've put these up, the ones about patience in particular, because the thing that's the major impediment to the mind of enlightenment is anger. So we need to rein in our anger. And the way you do that is with patience and loving kindness. So let's go and have a look at the perfections now. So in brief, there are, we know that there are actually 10, but they've been condensed into 6. So these are 6 important mental states that we need to develop if we wish to attain, really any positive concept, any positive effect in life. But because they're perfections, they're aimed at enlightenment for the benefit of others.
And Eddie, I think that's a really important point, and one that I often overlook, that it's not just ordinary generosity or ordinary ethics, but it's perfection of generosity and perfection of ethics, which is quite another level up.
That's right. Yeah. And of course, there are many, many benefits for developing these perfections. Of course, the greatest benefit is becoming fully awakened. And so here are the 6, of course. And we're going to have a look at patience. And these are the major divisions of patience, right? The first is learning to disregard harm inflicted by others. For us, this is probably one of the very, very, very difficult to do. And here's another one, though. The patience of learning to accept the different levels of suffering. This means that when you're undergoing suffering itself, accept that this is the way it is for people like ourselves. People who are unenlightened, finding themselves in cyclic existence. So that's what we mean by accepted. It does not mean to just accept suffering and just leave it alone, not do anything about it, or say something about somebody else's suffering, or that's their karma. It doesn't mean that. And thirdly, the patience of learning how to overcome all the adverse feelings that we have through our understanding of the Dharma. Now, so I'm just putting these up there. Of course, I've got much more I could say about all of them, but we're just going to focus on a couple of them here. So the first one I'll have a look at is this idea of voluntarily accepting suffering. So this is what we can do in relationship to it, ways of thinking. Right? Remind yourself that suffering is the nature of cyclic existence. If you say to yourself, look, I'm not enlightened, then this is natural to take place. But if we find ourselves as beings of cyclic existence, then suffering is its nature. So, in other words, don't beat yourself up or harm yourself because you're suffering.
Yeah, and there's always that thought that arises that says, yeah, but it shouldn't be like this.
Yeah, that's, once again, thought that's out of...
It's out of whack with reality.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
But it is a feeling that comes up.
Yeah, but it's like, it was before, I think, was somebody said, yeah, well, not all feelings are true. Not all feelings are in harmony with reality. But they're just feelings. Feelings come and go. And they're pleasant, unpleasant, or sort of neutral. But they don't have it's only when we latch onto them that we give them sort of greater power than what they actually have. It's when we cling to them that we have these, weird thoughts and stuff like that. So use the suffering to reduce your pride. So what do you think that would mean, anyone?
Using suffering to reduce pride.
Well, let's think about it. Next one, recall the impermanent nature of all phenomena. So, in terms of suffering, sometimes it's really obvious, sometimes it's not. We go up and down all the time. And every up and down is subject to change. Suffering itself is subject to change.
Eddie, the one of using suffering to reduce your pride, is that like how we don't actually even notice anyone is suffering until we ourselves suffer? And then we go, oh, right. So, you know, if you've never had a migraine or a headache, you just go, oh, come on, get over it. And then finally you have one and then you go, oh, all those people that's...
Yeah, so, you know, suffering can be used to reduce pride and bring about a sense of equanimity that we're the same and no different than anyone else. And we've always wanted to be happy and we're not. It also should point you to engage in the practice of Dharma. Suffering will not come to an end by itself. We've actually got to act. We've got to do something. So don't just take the pride of being a samsaric being and she'll be right, mate. It's really putting out, you have to do something.
So Jeanette's saying
it's just like having the pride of laziness.
Okay. And
Jeanette's saying
is it thinking that we're all the same, we're all in the same boat? You know.
Yeah, that's part of it. Yep. That's right. We're not, you know, as your example, if you know, we're not in the boat if you've never had a migraine headache.
Yeah. And so when you're talking about the pride, is that like a lackadaisical kind of approach, almost like as human beings we kind of have this sense of entitlement, like, you know, things should be good and la 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 and it's all fine while things are going fine?
Yeah, it's like this, because when we are feeling well, we think we're much better than what we actually are, you know. You know, it's like, once we're well, it's like, this is the way it is. Mm. You know, without, you know, forgetting, you know, the way I'm feeling is subject to change.
Yeah, and often when we suffer, we also get very embarrassed and we try and hide it. We don't want anybody to know.
Yeah. And, you know, recollect the plight of those worse off than yourself.
Right. So the humility, Anne says, the humility of then understanding others' suffering.
Yeah, that's right. It's a wonderful thing here. It's like you can learn something from suffering. If you pay attention, instead of just wanting to get rid of it, like, what's it showing me? What's it teaching me? And so if you're willing to learn, you've reduced your pride. You know, don't sort of take the stance that you know suffering's no good, so I shouldn't have it or get rid of it. It's like, while you're in the throes of it, what can you learn from this?
Hmm. So Anthea says, to know that suffering is usually because you have a sense of self and the eyes, feelings are hurt. So pride must be that, you know, part of that self-grasping.
Yeah.
So to reduce pride, you can place the suffering on your pride.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, this is the pride, the afflictive pride, the pride that's sort of, you know, wrongly aimed. And by doing all of these things, we turn our obstacles, like, into the path. Our obstacles, the obstacle of what we call sickness or suffering, becomes a part of our path to awaken. Yeah. So the big thing here, if we look at the path and how it's set out, everything, you know, so we have... the practices before bodhicitta are the practices of renunciation, right? We don't want this stuff. We do not want to have suffering, so we get rid of the causes. Right? So it's like, just get rid of it, all of it. This is saying here, once, if you can just acknowledge that you are suffering, that can be valuable to you. I can transform it. I know the deeper nature of suffering. I know that it's impermanent. It has no self. I am the same. Therefore, it's all malleable. It can all be brought into the path, into this path, the mind of enlightenment path. Whereas in the path of renunciation, we don't do this. We just see the faults of it. Yeah?
But like, also, If we didn't have renunciation, we wouldn't be able to do this, which is because we'd be panicking going, I don't want to suffer, I don't want to suffer. But here, because our focus is on other sentient beings, then the suffering doesn't freak us out.
Well, it becomes used to show when the suffering is not so much focused on self, and we acknowledge that others are in the same boat as we are, our own suffering diminishes, and it can become very useful in developing a mind of enlightenment.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's like that, you know, that wonderful story I always see is like, for most of us, you know, when we go to the toilet, we do a poo, we flush it away. It's like, dirty, off. In Japan or in other countries, they used to take the poo and put it into the garden and use it to grow vegetables and flowers and, you know, then eat the vegetables. So they take something that's seen as ugly, you know, to be discarded, and they make it something useful. Whereas others can see it as just being dirty and waste and just get rid of it. So here we're like taking this thing that most people don't like, and we're going to go, it's happening to me. It's right here. This is the reality. I'm not going to just disregard it or, you know, just sort of get rid of it. I can actually use this to develop greater qualities.
So this answers Nicola's question, which is, how does my suffering help anybody?
Mm-hmm. Now, it doesn't help them directly, but let me disqualify that, Nicola. So when my first wife was dying, then I looked at, you know, like, so she's suffering, of course. It was tremendous as a means for the students at our center to help themselves. Because a lot of people liked her, and then they ended up becoming helpers, volunteers at, you know, my house to make food. They'd come over, do practices with her, all sorts of things like that. And I said to her, you know, my wife would say that time, you know, when it gets really bad, you know, I just want you to sort of kill me. And I was fine for that. And I was like, yep, until I came into the Dharma. And it's like, oh. And I thought, well, actually, your suffering, I mean, even though you might not like it, it's really good for us. Because it can make us kinder people. It can make us more helpful people. You know, so when I talked to her, I thought, oh, there's no need to get embarrassed when you're in the hospital and the nurses have got to wipe your bottom. It's like, from my point of view, it's like, Dagger's view is, oh, it's wonderful. I can be here and help you be kinder and nicer people. I take the, you know, emphasis off my own embarrassment and place it on them and thinking, these people are doing a wonderful job. If I wasn't here, they'd never be able to do it. So that way, you know, like I said, look at your own suffering could be very valuable to others. Yeah, so here we're not going to reject suffering. We can accept it voluntarily. Now, here's another quote coming up now by Shanti Deva. So this here is, like I said, practice of patience is really one of the very best antidotes against the affliction of anger. And this is a quote about that. So Arya Shanti Deva says, even if it were the nature of the childish to cause harm to living beings, it would still be incorrect to be angry with them. Well, this would be like begrudging fire for having the nature to burn. So this is a verse to inspire within us patience so that we don't react to others when they harm us. You know, so when others harm us, there's two ways of looking at it. You can say, well, it's the nature of these people to harm us, or it's not.
That's like that scene, Eddie, in Natural Born Killers where the Native American Indian says, you know, if you're caring for a snake, don't be surprised if the snake bites you. You still care for the snake. You just be careful.
Yeah, yeah. You know, so here, So this is, of course, from the Bodhisattva's Way of Life, and there are a number of different commentaries on it. So I'll just read you a bit from two different commentaries. So this is one called by Pema Chodron called No Time to Lose. And it says, if we believe that people are basically bad by nature, then why get angry with them? Why not simply accept that they're prone to causing harm and let it go? Getting angry is like resenting fire for its heat. Then from a book called The Nectar of Manjushri's Speech, another commentary on Bodhisattva's Way of Life, he says, in the case of ordinary people who behave like foolish children, the question is, are they by their very nature prone to injure others or not? If they are, what point is there in being angry with them? It doesn't make any sense. It's like being annoyed with fire when we touch it and get burned. But, you know, it's true, isn't it? You know, so this is a way of, you know, some of those people like think like that, the childish people, right? For people like us, we can naturally become childish because we forget the Dharma. We forget that actually that person who's harming other living beings is under the control of delusion and karma. It's those things that are the major thing I should be putting my effort at, not the person. The person is my kind teacher, my mother, all those sort of things. But if we forget that, you know, like I said, and we wish to strike back at those who harm us, we're sort of thinking, aren't they, by nature, this person, a harmful being. So once again, we're sort of confusing the behavior with the person, which lots of people do. Now, when we look at the perfections, each of the six can also be conjoined with the other six, meaning that we could have, like for instance, with patience, we could have the generosity of patience. We could have the ethical discipline of patience. We could have the patience of patience. And this goes right through all of the perfections. So I just want to introduce those to you. Once again, the point is, you know, in one of the examinations, they ask you, can you tell us a little bit about patience? And, you know, here you can say, well, I know there are three types of patience. And, you know, you can drop down a couple of these. So patience and the perfections. The generosity of patience is to lead others into the practice of patience with instructions. So you're being generous with your speech and your time and your intelligence. You're extending it out to others. The ethical discipline of patience, don't break your vows or harm others. The patience of patience, aspire to continue practicing. The joyous effort of patience, do the practice with joy and energy and overcome your obstacles. So it's always good, like once you find, you know, you've been able to sort of apply what you understand and not respond to anger with anger or harm with harm. It's quite a, I found it to be quite a surprise. You actually know what you've done. You know, we're actually, when you harm others, you know after you've done it and then you have regret. But with this type of patience, it's like a knowledge of what you're doing while you're doing it. And there's a sense of joy that comes up while you're doing it because you know what you're doing. You're conscious about this. You know, and you will overcome the obstacle of being angry, impatient, short-thrifted, and so forth. The meditative stabilization of patience means keep the mind tranquil and undistracted. And finally, the wisdom of patience, practice skillfully. Discriminate between right and wrong practice. So, in terms of the meditative stabilization of patience, it means you have to be mindful, remember what you're trying to do, and you need to sort of focus on the objects. are when practicing patience. So, you know, like we know that when we become impatient, it all becomes problematic. So we have to sort of like discriminating between right and wrong. So, you know, being right here is just that. You are patient because you know the nature of reality. Everything depends upon something else.
So, Ed, is this where we use our reasoning?
You hope that you already used your reasoning beforehand so that you can now actually be patient. So when you come to practice, you know, when somebody harms you with their speech or says something unskillful to you, probably even, you know, deliberately or otherwise, you know what's right and what's wrong in terms of your response. You know that if you respond in the same way, it will escalate. Mm. You know? So you voluntarily accept the unpleasant feeling that might arise in you when that person has said that.
Yes, yeah, so Jeanette said it is a great feeling when you can remain calm
in the face of an angry person. Yeah, it is.
And it might even have a remarkably good effect on the other person too, if you can remain peaceful.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I mean, it certainly would with kitties, doesn't it, if you remain peaceful.
Yeah, yeah. And when you don't, you know what happens then. That's the same sort of thing even with your spouses, you know, or your adult children. You respond with, you know, harm for harm. It's just like, you know, what they say a lot. Let's make the whole world blind. Let's set the whole world on fire. That would be good. Okay, let's move on now to verse 9. So here, like I said, you know, verses 3, 4, 5, we begin with the importance of renunciation, the methods for developing it, and then the measurement of success. The bodhicitta was the importance of bodhicitta, the methods for developing bodhicitta, and the measurement of success. It's very similar here, but it's a little bit different. But we begin with the importance of the view. So here it says, though familiar with renunciation and bodhicitta, you cannot cut the root of compulsive existence without wisdom realizing the ultimate nature. Therefore, use every means to realize dependent arising. So we're becoming familiar with renunciation and bodhicitta. At first I was sort of saying, you know, what if you actually had authentic renunciation and authentic bodhicitta? Well, even if you haven't, you can't get out of this compulsive existence. You can't get out of the cycle of uncontrolled rebirth or rebirth under the control of karma and delusion and all the suffering that goes with it. So that you can't put an end to it just with renunciation, just with the wish for freedom, and just with the wish to become enlightened for the sake of others. You have to have this wisdom that realizes the ultimate nature of phenomena. He says, well, how do you get that wisdom? He says, well, use every means you can to realize dependent arising. So it's from this point on that the text explains the nature of emptiness and the wisdom that realizes it. And this verse is explaining the need to generate the wisdom realizing the nature of emptiness through understanding dependent arising. So there are various kinds of wisdom. You know, there's the wisdom understanding the conventional nature. There's the wisdom realizing how to listen, how to reflect, how to meditate. So a number of different types of wisdom. But here it's the wisdom realizing the ultimate nature. That wisdom is called the wisdom realizing emptiness. This is, you know, like I said, try and realize dependent arising. Now, dependent arising has got a number of different levels of understanding that you can, because so you can bring a number of different levels of your understanding to dependent arising. Now, the first level is and they often call this going from the gross level to the subtle, meaning from the simple level to the difficult. So the simple level of dependent arising is that if the phenomena is a produced phenomena, if it depends upon, if it's a product, if it's a product, it will disintegrate. And its disintegration is taking part because it depends upon causes and conditions. So there's the dependency. Every product depends upon causes and conditions. And a product that does depend upon causes and conditions is impermanent and empty of any true existence.
So there's kind of our answer right there. When anything that depends on causes and conditions is impermanent, and so much of our suffering comes from the shock of discovering that things have changed and that they're impermanent.
Yeah, that's right. They've always been that way. You know, we ask, like, why are they impermanent? It's because they depend upon causes and conditions that are not in their control. Some of you will find, you are married, aren't you? That marriage is a product. It comes together depend upon the causes and conditions that have produced it. If those causes and conditions fall away, you'll find yourself not married. So your marriage is dependent upon the causes and conditions that produce it. We are persons. We are products, meaning we are dependent upon our existence, independent upon the causes and conditions that produced us. What produced our physical body? It's a union of mum and dad. Sperm and blood is the sort of most subtle thing. Come together, now we have a body. That body is a product. It was dependent upon causes and conditions. Because it's dependent upon causes and conditions, it is impermanent. Why? Because if you take away or reduce the cause of conditions, the product itself will disintegrate, will come apart, will no longer exist. Why does that? Because it depends upon those causes and conditions. Those causes and conditions are also products. They also depend upon other phenomena, so they are also impermanent.
So that's like us, depending on just food and drink every day of our lives. And if the food and drink conditions don't come about, then that's the end of our life.
That's right. So our life is dependent upon air, food, liquids. It's dependent upon a whole lot of different phenomena. It's dependent upon the sunshine. There's so many dependencies there. And this is what they call the simple level of gross dependent arising. And this is not the level they're talking about in this verse. Now, a second level of dependent arising, which is more difficult to understand, but also does exist, is how things depend upon their parts. So we look at, here we'll first of all look at produced phenomena and then unproduced phenomena. So you and I are produced phenomena. We have our parts, our body and mind. When the body and mind are together, we have a person called me, us, Hank, Marty, Karen. So those are two parts, like that to come together. But there's also the name. That's another part, isn't it? So we've got those three parts there. So the parts go right across every sort of produced phenomenon. So now we've got causes and conditions and parts. Now there's another type of phenomena which are unproduced, which are not dependent upon causes and conditions. But they do depend upon parts. So they're still dependent. Whatever the phenomena is, whether they be permanent, whether they be produced or unproduced, they depend upon something else.
So is that why it's a level subtler? Because it's not necessarily causes and conditions, but just the parts.
Just the parts, that's right, because the phenomena is a bit different, you know. It is unproduced phenomena, which most people don't have much knowledge of, although it exists. But many people don't know, like, what? You know, we don't come across many permanent phenomena, unchanging, unproduced phenomena in our lives. In fact, in terms of the explanation of Dharma, from the perspective of Abhidharma, when they put up 75 different types of Dharmas, or 75 different types of existent, 72 of them are unproduced, and only three are, 72 of them are produced phenomena, meaning they depend upon causes and conditions and parts. Whereas the unproduced phenomena, there's only three of them.
So that answers Jeanette's question, which is, so is everything in the world dependent on causes and conditions? The answer is 72 things.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. If we categorized all phenomena into the way that the Abhidharma text does, you'd go, no, there are 72 things. Of all the things that exist, we've categorized them to be 72 of them, and they are impermanent, subject to change. But there are three that are not. Yeah, so that answers that question. And like I said, just as you point out, you know, not many people know this. You know, as soon as you talk about permanent phenomena, you talk to anyone who's not studying Dharma, they'll get a shock. You know, straight away. The only people I know who talk about, like, permanent, unchanging is like God. Anyway, we'll leave that alone for the moment. So this is also not the dependent horizon you're talking about. So the most subtle level of dependent arising, which is the one that's been mentioned actually in this verse, is how phenomena depend upon conception, meaning a consciousness, and name. So this is the most subtle dependent arising. It's also called the subtle conventional truth.
And so by name, Eddie, do you mean by being identified?
With a name.
With a name.
Yeah. So the pin arising referred to in this line is the subtlest one, in which is explained in terms of existing merely by name and designation by thought. So name and designation by thought.
So can you just say what those three are again?
Okay. Dependent upon causes and conditions is the first. Dependent upon parts is the second. Dependent upon designation in terms. Name and thought is another way of saying it. So this is difficult to get your head around. However, it becomes much easier once if you apply the reason that comes about to show how things are empty of inherent nature. Once you've done that, then you come back out and go, oh, it's not that they don't exist. They don't exist inherently. But then there's this problem, you know, describing, well, how do they exist? I know it's not like that. How? The only things you can come up with is through awareness and name. If it's not substantially existed, if it's not objectively existed, it's not ultimately existent, it's not inherently existent, it's not existent from its own side, all these different terms you can use. It's not like that. It doesn't, you go, okay, yeah, but how? Like, I'm asking how it doesn't exist. I want to know how it does exist. And you go, it depends upon thought and name.
Well, that actually makes a lot of sense.
Well, now we need, it's nearly time to finish. Of course, there's much more to say about this. But I do suggest, if you're really interested in this, to have a look at that book called Teachings from Tibet. Like I said, we have them here. They only cost, I think, about a dollar online. And this material is really, really well written. I think from page 165 to 167. So it's only like two pages. It explains it there. But I'll just say a couple of more things here. The penderizing referred to in this line is the subtlest one, in which it is explained in terms of existing merely by name and designation by thought. In other words, when we say that a phenomenon exists through the power of terms and designations, and it depends on designations, we are explaining the penderizing as it appears, as mere existence due to the power of name. From the ultimate point of view, that is mere emptiness of inherent existence. This means that since a phenomena cannot come into being from its own side, it lacks inherent existence and is dependent on other conditions. Here, other conditions refer to designation and the designating thought. The phenomena exists merely by the power of that designation, and as such, it is empty of any self-sufficient existence. Conversely, since it is empty of self-sufficient existence, it exists through the power of designation. So this shows the wonderful relationship between emptiness and dependent arising, dependent designation. I do suggest, I know this could sound quite confusing to you. It is confusing even after you hear it. So it will take a bit of time, but it's so worthwhile time spent checking this out. So what I would suggest you do is take any type of phenomena, like an apple, a TV screen, whatever it is. You go, that's a phenomena. Eddie said it depends upon causes and conditions, does it? You'll work out very quickly, yep. He also said it depended upon parts. Has it got parts? Yeah, yep. Then he says it depends upon a consciousness to realize it there and an aim for it to be that thing. Is that true? So you're definitely going to say, well, I only know the screen is in front of me because my visual consciousness is focused on it. Then it's arising, to my awareness, and I give it a name.
So would that mean that even if you had the TV, but you put it in the middle of the Amazon jungle and a tribe came along that didn't know what a TV was?
Yeah.
To them, it's not a TV.
That's right. So some of you might have seen that fantastic film. I don't know how many long years ago it was, now maybe 20 years.
Oh, The Gods Must Be Crazy.
The Gods Must Be Crazy. Right? When there's a man flying over Africa with his girlfriend, they get passionate in their helicopter and a Coke bottle falls out. Falls through space and lands, and an African man finds it. And he goes, like, what is this? It fell out of the sky. It must be a gift from the gods. Right? So there you go. Like, what is this thing? How do you determine it's a gift from the gods? Well, you have to place your eyes on it. You have to pick it up. So now you've got eye consciousness when you pick it up. You've got, what's it called? Physical consciousness. Like he looks at it, he peers it up, he taps it, he uses all of his awarenesses to determine, like, what is this thing? He doesn't know, but he gives it the name, gift from the gods. Right? So it doesn't have Coke bottle from its own side, because if it did, this guy would go, it's a Coke bottle. Right? its actuality is dependent upon cause and conditions that produce one. The Coke bottle does have parts, but name and awareness. And this is the type of dependent arising we're talking about here.
So quite a few people have seen this movie. Anne says, great movie. Anthea says, saw it with her family and never seen her dad laugh so hard.
Yeah, well, yeah, and, you know, and actually her dad laughing so hard is a, you know, when you get there's two things that are interrelated, I think, with a good understanding of emptiness and dependent arising is great laughter, but also great sadness. Because for those who don't realize that it's empty and dependent, they grip things as being real. You know? And what will happen is you saw in the tribe, wasn't it? Was that when he took it there, everybody started going, it's this, it's this, it's that. And they all started arguing about it. That's just what we do. We're just arguing with our designations that have been put on it by consciousness and names. That's what we're actually arguing about.
So Jeanette's head's just exploded. She's saying, I feel the class has gone way too fast and I need to spend more time to think about things that I'm feeling too old. So Jeanette, I'd suggest get this movie out and have a good laugh and then go back to your studies.
Yeah. Anyway, look, folks, I've got to just summarise this and we have to finish up quickly, unfortunately. But I'll come back to this again next week when we talk about the view. So basically, we're looking at the advanced level of practitioner and in particular the mind of enlightenment. We focused on giving and taking and the perfection of patience. That was all contained in verse 8. When we come to verse 9. Where we're talking about the importance of the view. So verse 8 had giving and taking, perfection of patience, and this measurement of success. How do I know I have a mind of enlightenment? In brief, it's when it's uncontrived, when it doesn't require any effort to think about it. You've got the mind of enlightenment. And today we look at the importance of the view. And Lama Tsongkhapa says, it's important because without it, you cannot be free of cyclic existence, and you cannot become a fully enlightened being either. So it's that important. But the way to discover the empty nature of all phenomena is to come at it through realizing dependent arising. And so today I've answered two of the questions that you'll find in the different forms of examination or review. And have a look at some of this material that might help you. Pages 24 to 26 FPMT readings, pages 1 to 7 of the three principal aspects of the path review. So this is the one written by Khyentse Rinpoche, Geshe Tashi Seren. It's tremendous. There's a meditation on bodhicitta also. If you can, give it your best shot. Memorize these verses. And next week, there's more practices on the advanced level. Really focusing around the view and these perfections of concentration and wisdom. So I'm going to stop the share now, and if there's anything anybody else would like to add to it or ask, have a final question, please do so.
The final question was, what was that movie again? And the answer is, the gods must be crazy.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah, it's a tremendous film to see. I mean, it was great fun when you first saw it. But here it's even better when you look at it through the lens of Dharma study. So, folks, thank you once again for being here each Tuesday with me. I love what we're doing, and I can only do it because you're here. So I want to dedicate to your development of the mind of enlightenment and eventual full awakening to bring about the welfare of all sentient beings, repaying the kindness of our teachers and our mothers, and of course bringing about your own welfare too. May this come about as quickly as possible, and may the merit also be extended to all living beings, so that they too may come into contact with the path, authentic and legitimate teachers, and bring about the realizations of that path. So we also acknowledge that anything that conventionally exists, which is everything I've been talking about, does so dependently. And as it does dependently exist, it lacks any type of intrinsic nature. So with that understanding, we dedicate to the goals I've mentioned. And may you be happy all week. May you live meaningful lives during the week. Do worthwhile things. And I hope to see you all again next week. So thank you, everyone.
And now, those of you who are still with us, please turn on your cameras and...
And I can say, hello, Anne. How are you? Anne, Thea, good to see you. Alison and June, lovely to see you all. Hi, Jeanette. Who else have we got here? There's Nicola. How are you, sweetie? And Sue, lovely to see you, Sue. Okay. I mean, thank you. And see you again.
Lovely class, everyone. Thanks for coming along. See you soon.